Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. More than 50 years later, there are still people, especially of a certain age, who reminisce about Woodstock. Even if you weren't there, the music festival in New York took on a meaning that goes beyond just those who performed on stage. It represented some hope at one of its lowest points. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from a group of Native people invited to Woodstock, and we'll hear whether it lived up to its promise. We're back right after the news.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a mother.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new report from the Government Accountability Office says the federal government is not doing enough to tackle the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie explains.
Advocates have long argued that Indigenous women go missing or are murdered at much higher rates than other demographics. In recent years, Congress passed two laws addressing the issue. But the new GAO report shows that the Justice and Interior Departments are missing important milestones set by the legislation. For example, the agencies failed to create a joint commission to reduce violent crime against Native Americans. And while the Justice Department has begun analyzing data on missing and murdered Indigenous people, it doesn't have a plan yet to continue after this month. Lynette Grable is the director of the nonprofit Not Our Native Daughters. And she's not surprised by the report.
You know, it takes a lot of effort to make things happen and get not only your staff and program and an entire government agency trained on the issue, but also to move forward and implement that.
That said, she also believes the agencies and law enforcement are taking this issue more seriously these days. But it's tough to know where to begin. After the release of the report, members of Congress said the federal government must begin implementing its recommendations. For National Native News, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland hosted the session Elevating Indigenous Youth at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow Friday. Young people from around the world asked questions to panelists in pre-recorded videos. They also voiced concerns about their communities and cultures being at risk due to climate change. Students from Igiagig, Alaska talked about food and other resources.
My name is Seth Hobson Hisalik. I'm in seventh grade in Igiagig School. In our village, we are concerned about climate change we have seen in our area of Alaska. Snow is arriving later and melting earlier. Land is being washed away into the water. The lake is getting smaller each year. Our grandparents used to catch more salmon here, but now the warming oceans are limiting the salmon we catch.
Other students talked about flooding, drought, irregular weather patterns, and environmental justice. Secretary Haaland spoke about work on the federal level to move to a clean energy economy with an emphasis on underrepresented communities. She says it's important to hear from Native youth.
I am incredibly inspired when I have opportunities to meet with young people. So we're going to keep doing that. And that is my commitment to all of you as well. We're going to keep making sure that those young folks have an opportunity to speak with us because we're going to take a lot of direction from them.
Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Brian Newland co-hosted the panel, which included representatives from world Indigenous organizations. The Bureau of Land Management has finalized the first federal land allotments as part of the Alaska Native Vietnam Era Veteran Land Allotment Program. Through the program, the BLM can provide those eligible to select an allotment of up to 160 acres of federal lands in Alaska or land selected by the state or Native corporations. The program is for Alaska Native Vietnam veterans who did not have access to land allotments while serving in the Vietnam War. The BLM is working with other federal agencies, including the Department of the Interior, to identify veterans and their families. According to the Interior Department, more than 1,400 veterans and families have been contacted, and nearly 130 applications have been received. Land selection is open through December 2025. More information about the program can be found on the BLM's website, blm.gov. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the annual Native Cinema Showcase. 47 films representing 39 Native nations in 13 countries, available from November 12th to the 18th on demand at americanindian.si.edu. Support by AARP. The Native Urban Elder Needs Assessment Survey will provide data to improve urban Indian elder health equity. Elders are underrepresented in data, and you can help. Info and survey at uiacoalition.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Woodstock is one of the most storied music events of all time. Initially conceived as a means to finance a studio, it became a gathering that changed the course of popular music. It also galvanized the influence of a younger generation while the country was divided over an unpopular war and violent racial politics. A group of Native artists were invited to Woodstock to showcase their work. The gathering was billed as a music and arts festival, and the artists were hopeful to reach new markets. What unfolded, however, was completely unexpected and memorable. We're going to talk to some of those who were there and hear about what they experienced. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Are you a Native child of the 60s? Were you or someone you know at Woodstock? Does it hold up to its status as one of the most significant cultural events in modern times? Give us a call to join the discussion. As always, the number 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us today from the village of Powhatan on tribal lands of Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico is Charlie Bird. He was a Woodstock attendee, and he's Laguna and Santo Domingo Pueblo. Charlie, welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning. Thank you.
Joining us from Morris, Oklahoma is Sandy Fife Wilson. She is an artist and retired art teacher and graduate of the Institute of American Indian Arts. She's Muscogee Creek and also a Woodstock attendee. Welcome to Native America Calling, Sandy.
Thank you.
And joining us from Henrietta, Oklahoma is Sharon Mouse. She is Sandy's sister, a Woodstock attendee, and a retired college instructor. She is also Muscogee Creek. Welcome to Native America Calling, Sharon.
Thank you, and good morning.
I just can't get over this fact that there was a group of young Native people that traveled to Woodstock in the summer of 1969. Just beyond cool. Really, really cool. Charlie, I'd like to begin with you. Summer of 69, how old were you? What were you doing? Where were you living? And what inspired you to travel to Woodstock?
I was not even a student at the Institute in Santa Fe. I just happened to be seeing a gal who was going to school at the time, and she told me about it. She had heard about this big music and arts fair that was going to happen in New York, and it sounded interesting. So I spoke to one of the guys who was one of the contacts. His name was Rosa, and he was in contact with John Morris, who was one of the biggies concerning Woodstock. And a couple of days later, he asked me, you still want to go? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're in. And got tickets the vast majority of all the students went with the hog farm on a charter plane. We had private tickets, and then we got on the plane in Albuquerque, flew to New York, got off the plane, and there was a guy calling my name, and he was our chauffeur, and he was driving our car, which was pretty far out. Anyway, they had us all set up in a little town called White Lake, with room and board and all that stuff. And then the following day, our driver, Mario, drove us up to the site, and there were a lot of people walking, a lot of people heading that way, and this was like on Wednesday, I believe. I remember exactly. I think it was on Wednesday that before it even started. And one thing he did say was, just right over this next hill is the concert. And we got to the top of the hill and looked down, and there was this tremendous, huge, beautiful grass-covered bowl, and there were a lot of people there already. And it was very exciting just looking at that. And we hung around for a couple of days waiting for things to happen, and then the day when things were supposed to happen, it took a long time. And a little while ago, it was nice to hear Richie Havens, because he was the first artist that appeared, and it was just by accident that he was first, because they couldn't get the other guys in, and that's when they started using the helicopters to bring all the artists and their equipment in. And because nothing was moving, according to everything I've heard and read about it later on the highways, it was just jammed, backed up to the main roads. And
Charlie,
all I can
you say. So there was this group from Santa Fe. How big was your group? How many Native students or companions were there who made the trip to Woodstock?
20, I'm not sure. Yeah.
About 20. Now,
and they all were supposed to have their artwork either flown in or it was supposed to be in New York, but then they couldn't get it out to the site because of the traffic and whatnot. And so that part of the art show never happened. And there was actually a pavilion that was built for the artists, for the Indian artists. It was called the Indian Pavilion. And I understand, I never even saw it, to tell you the truth, but I understand that before, a couple of days before everything opened up, it was just full of people who were squatting in there, so I don't know.
So it just got so overrun that this idea that you would sell artwork and there would be like a cultural pavilion showcasing some Native American art and other performance type stuff, that just wasn't possible, huh? With so many people?
Yeah. Like I said, a lot of their artwork didn't arrive up there. Couldn't get in. They couldn't deliver it. And it was just incredible.
Now, Charlie, your group was invited to come to Woodstock by the promoters, and you enjoyed some special privileges. What were the perks?
Well, John Morris was the guy who was in charge of making arrangements for us all to get there. And like I said, the majority of the guys went on the plane with the hog farm, who were in charge of security, and my brother, myself, a gal named Rosanna Sneed, went separately on by ourselves with our tickets. And when we got there, we had a hotel room in White Lake, and then we had a chauffeur, and he could take us anytime, anywhere we wanted to go. And when we got to the site, to the area, there was a couple of teepees that were set up for us, which were incredible, which they kind of was a great thing to have, and we were sheltered. So out of all the people that were there, we stayed dry and not too muddy, and we had passes backstage, we had performer passes, we had pavilion passes. We could go anywhere and do anything, and it was incredible. It was great.
Okay, Charlie, let me get this right. So you were this group of young Native kids from New Mexico, and you had teepees set up at Woodstock, and you were hanging out in these teepees throughout the concert?
Well, it would have been hard to get a Pueblo over there. So, yeah. Well, they were set up away from the area in a group of trees, so there was quite a bit of privacy. It was from the opposite end of the main entrance, and so there was hardly anybody that came by. And so we did have privacy and not much interference from people just walking by. There were a few people just walking by who wanted to look in the teepees, and then when they found out Indians, I mean, you gotta remember, this is New York. Indians, they were just so fascinated by all of us. Most of them, not all of them, but they were just really excited about meeting Indians. And it was really fun.
It just sounds like such an amazing experience. Charlie, on Woodstock was a 4-day concert, right? And the final day of the concert, Jimi Hendrix was the closing act. And his set included classics, Purple Haze, Hey Joe, Foxy Lady, and an iconic rendition of the Star Spangled Banner, which is considered one of the greatest rock and roll performances of all time. And unfortunately, Hendrix, he died just a little more than a year later and has since, of course, been elevated to like this superhuman, I would say like a transcendent legacy, right? Jimi Hendrix. Charlie, you actually witnessed that performance standing on the stage only a few feet away. Here you were, this Pueblo kid from New Mexico on stage during Jimi Hendrix's set. It just blows me away that you were able to experience that. I know also that the promoters of Woodstock, John Morris, you mentioned, and Mel Lawrence, they later moved to Santa Fe, and they were relatively involved with Native American culture, and they were kind of connected with some Native people. And it's just so interesting that these stories about this whole experience have really never been told. And I'm just so, so happy that you and our other guests are on the show today to share this wonderful history. We have to go to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Sean Spruce.
Native prison inmates have secured some religious freedoms over the years, but the effort to maintain access to many spiritual ceremonies and other religious activities remains a constant battle. One program in the Pacific Northwest offers spiritual, economic, and educational access for indigenous people behind bars. We'll hear more about it on the next Native America Calling.
Our ancestors and elders taught us how to live in balance and care for all living beings. They cared for us, so now we care for them. Caregivers, it's time to take care of you. It's okay to take a break. It's okay to ask for help. Remember, you're not alone. Connected together, we'll stand strong. More on elder isolation and caregiver resources at connectedindigenouselders.org. The National Indian Council on Aging supports this show.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We're hearing today from a group of Native people who found themselves at Woodstock more than 50 years ago. Their memory of the event endures. If you'd like to ask a guest a question, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-996-2848. I'd like to bring in our next guest, Sandy Fife Wilson. And Sandy, I want to start off the same question I asked Charlie. What were you doing in the summer of 1969, and what prompted you to go to Woodstock?
Well, I had graduated from IIA that June, and I was 18 years old. I was home in Oklahoma, and Bill Souza called, and he asked me if I wanted to go to New York, and he said that they were having a music and art festival up there, and he was getting together, I think it seemed like there were about 10 of us from the Institute to demonstrate and show our artwork. So he talked to me, told me a little bit about that. And from what I heard, it wasn't planned to be as big as it was. So I said I would go. And I think he talked to my sisters about sending, about going to, but they couldn't go. Two of them are artists. And,
Sandy, in your opinion, was Woodstock the iconic event that it's become famous for? Was it all that?
I think so. You know, when we got up there, there were so many people, and it turned out that it started raining, and so we never did get our art out to do. But like Charlie said, we had a green shirt we were given with the emblem on it, Woodstock emblem, and that was a former shirt, I think, and we could go to the tents to eat, we could go on stage, we could go about any place we wanted. And that was our pass.
You mentioned
group?
I'm sorry, Sandy. Go ahead, Sandy. Finish your thought.
The groups that were there were so large, well known, that it's just amazing. But when we heard about it, he paid. Well, Bill Sosa got us tickets on the, we flew out there and then we had to go on a train and a bus, and here we were. We were all dressed up, ready to go to New York, and we kept seeing all the hippies everywhere, all over the place, and we kept wondering, where are they going? And it wasn't until we got there we actually knew, but it was pretty amazing. Just hadn't been around. I was in Santa Fe, and there were hippies there, but I hadn't been in close contact with a lot of them. But everybody was real nice, and it was just a good trip. But they had everything taken care of. With our transportation, our lodging, everything. And it was amazing to go driving, Bill driving us in that big old long station wagon. And here we were all dressed up, and people were just walking down the roads.
Sure.
They'd move over and let us by.
Sandy, you've had a distinguished career as an artist and a teacher. And I'm sorry, but I'm having kind of a hard time imagining you as this free-spirited child of the 60s. Do you have a little bit of a wild streak in you? Are you that super cool auntie or mom that lets everybody stay out late and crank the music up really loud? Tell us the truth, Sandy.
I do that, but not too awfully wild. I was pretty tame. I mean, I wasn't a wild child. I was pretty good.
You mentioned
behavior wise
shirt.
And everything at school.
Uh-huh. Sandy, you mentioned a shirt earlier. Do you still have souvenirs or any photos from Woodstock?
I have that shirt, and that's about all. I don't know what happened to my program, my other things. And our brother had been in Vietnam, and he got a Canon camera. And so we took his camera with us, and my sister Sharon, she took a lot of photographs. And back then, you had to send the film off to get it developed. And all our films got lost. They said, they were lost, so. We don't have any pictures.
And you took pictures and they were lost.
Yes, that's what they said.
Wow. Wow. I'd like to bring your sister, Sharon, into the conversation. Sharon, you and Sandy are sisters. How did you come to come along on this trip?
Well, I was 25 at the time, and I had been working for a while, and out of college, I was working at Tinker Air Force Base, and she just seemed very young to be traveling to New York. So I asked her if she wanted me to go with her, and she says, well, I guess. And so I was sort of invited myself to go. I wasn't an artist, but more of an observer of the whole thing. And it was quite an eye-opener for me. And it was just quite an experience. And when Charlie talked about that two-lane road and Sandy talked about the Bill Sosa picking us up and taking us to Woodstock, well, when he met us and we got in line in the line of, or we were going to get in line of traffic, a police officer came over. I don't know if he was highway, but he was on a motorcycle. He came over and he said, you folks might as well go home because there's 11 miles of bumper to bumper traffic and you'll never make it to that festival. And Bill Sosa said, and Sandy and I were sitting in the back seat, like she said, we were all dressed up. And Bill Sosa said, well, I have to get there because I have entertainers in the back seat that they have to be there. And that policeman kneeled down and looked back at us, and he says, oh, okay, follow me. And so he turned on his lights and siren and sped us through the middle of the two lanes all the way to the festival. So we got there fine.
VIP treatment.
Wow. We got that right off the bat. But and then Bill gave us T-shirts, and we had to change clothes. We just put our T-shirts and jeans on in the parking lot behind our car doors and went on up to the teepees. And that's the first time I ever stayed in a teepee. They were very nice. And on the floor of the teepee and around in that area, there was just like 4 to 6 inches of deco bark. So all of that rain just flowed underneath. You know, we didn't get wet, or we had a nice place to stay. So,
Sharon, one thing Woodstock is infamous for, along with the entire 60 revolution, is this free-spirited hippie culture. The drugs, the nudity. I got to ask, it's in the job description. Did you see some of that at Woodstock? Because Indian Country wants to know. We're dying to hear.
Yes, that was all there. People didn't seem to think. I mean, they didn't act like anything about it. You know, everybody was doing their own thing, and not, there was no judgmental attitude anywhere. And like I said, I was the observer, not the artist. So there was probably not as much nudity as everybody thinks. But I remember on the loudspeakers, they had a tent with doctors and first aid. And if someone got sick from drugs or whatever, then they would make announcements over the loudspeakers, you know, be careful of these. And they'd name the little whatever made that person sick. And I thought, well, everybody's just trying to help each other through this. I don't know. It was just, the whole thing was such an eye-opener. I mean, for a person from Oklahoma who was a...
Sandy, when I first found out that a group of young Native artists were at Woodstock, I remember being really surprised. I was like, how come I have never heard of this before? This should be like a big deal. I would think there'd be articles about it. There'd be books about this. Why do you think your story of a group of Native students from IAIA going to Woodstock, why do you think that's not more known in Indian Country?
I don't know. I have always wondered that myself, because we were there, and I guess because the art part of the concert, I mean, the 3 days of art music, the art was left out because of the rain. And so they never had anything about it. But in all the pictures and books and things, films I've seen, I have never seen the teepees up on that hill. And I thought, they had some of those.
That just makes me more sad about that, those pictures being lost. Sharon, I'd like to ask you, because, everybody's heard about the rain and just, there were 400,000 people at Woodstock. It was complete. I think that it was a farm, right? I think they were designed, they had about a capacity safely for about 150,000 people. So there were well over twice that number that actually went to the concert. Tell us a little bit about the facilities, showers, restrooms. Sharon, were you folks able to maintain hygiene during that whole 4 days?
They had started out with a big, long row of porta potties. But when the rains came and everything was just flooded, and they had some showers, I guess, faucets and showers just bare, sticking out of the ground, on a pipe in some areas. I don't know. I don't even know where. Some of the stuff I don't remember, like eating. I don't recall eating very much, except a couple of times. And we walked to town one day, and the whole bunch of, I guess they were constantly walking up and down, but that road to the town, and all of the residents of the town were kind of lined up on the side of the road, just watching, just looking, or sitting on their porches looking. And some of them had their hoses out there, and they'd hose you down if you wanted them to. But I don't remember that, but they did invite us to the hog farm to whatever. We ate breakfast there one time, and I thought, well, we'll have breakfast. And it was oatmeal, raisins, and peanuts in a paper cup. Not cooked, just raw oatmeal. So, like, granola, I guess. But I don't recall.
Did you like the music? Do you remember any particular acts that stood out?
Yes, I liked, Joan Baez was there. I liked her. And Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Arlo Guthrie, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Creedence Clearwater. I love them. Santana was there, but I didn't know much about him at that time, but I've kind of watched him since, and not too long ago, one of my nieces bought me a purse that he designed, and it was real popular with when I'd carry it, and mostly women my age, the Woodstock age, gave me compliments on it. But I thought that was funny. But
Sharon, it doesn't quite sound like Woodstock was the conscious raising experience that it's become known for and so famous for. And I think of all that's been documented about Woodstock over the years, and books and movies and documentaries. Tell us, are there any secrets that have yet to be told? Do you remember something else that just has never been shared about Woodstock? Spill the tea, please.
No, not necessarily that, but I was, like Sandy, I have been so surprised that the teepees never made the books and the publications. And I just wonder why. I mean, out in the midst of all of this, there were two teepees up on a hill and a camp of Indians. And it was like, why didn't they put us in something? I mean, I thought that was very unusual for the Indians to be camped there. And no one did it, gave us any publicity.
Two teepees on a hill and a camp of Indians. That's classic, Sharon. Did you notice? I mean, you were a group of about 20. It sounds like Charlie remembers about 20 of you. Did you notice any other Native people there? Any other kids that were Native at the shows?
No, I didn't. But when we first got there, the first two people we met were from Purcell, Oklahoma. Yeah, that was odd of all those people. But no, I didn't see any. But
Sharon, if you could describe your entire Woodstock experience using just one word, what would it be? Think on it, Sharon.
I couldn't describe it in one word. It was, okay. I didn't know it was going to be this.
No worries. Folks, if you have a comment or question for today's show, call in 1-800-996-2848. We'll be back right after this break.
Support by Navajo Language Renaissance, presenting Rosetta Stone Navajo for Apple and Android devices with two learning levels, a self-correcting pronunciation feature, and a new Level 1 workbook designed to make learning Navajo easier. Info at NavajoRenaissance.org.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. What is your perception of Woodstock? Is it a history-changing cultural phenomenon or overblown hype that age-affluent folks won't stop talking about? Our number, 1-800-996-2848. What are you waiting for? Pick up that phone and call. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Before we went to break, I asked Sharon if she could describe her Woodstock experience in just one word, what would it be? And she couldn't really quite grasp it. She feels it's maybe too significant for just one word. But Sharon, I want to follow up with that and ask you, do you feel that that experience at Woodstock, did it change you? Do you think you'd be the person you are today had you never gone to Woodstock?
No, it didn't change me, but if I ever mention to anyone that I went there, they just can't get over it. And the first thing they say is, were you wallowing that mud? But no, they are so in awe of the whole experience of Woodstock. And I am more of a calm, straight person that they can't believe that I went there. And so it didn't change me in any way, except I think about it a lot. And I like to look at publications about it. And I always, like Sandy, I'm always looking for those teepees, but I haven't found them anywhere. And when Jimi Hendrix was on the stage, I went up there with some others from the camp, and we weren't too far from them. And finally, I found a picture that looks like me and three Indian guys behind Jimi Hendrix. And I always said I was right behind his right elbow, not close, but that was the point that I, point of reference that I made. But finally found a picture, and I always thought we were so close enough to be in some picture. But usually, you know, it stopped at his, just with him. But I think I finally found a picture that had us in it. So.
Right. That's, well, I know there is a picture, and we couldn't use the picture online because it's a copywritten photo, but there is a picture online of Charlie, and he's personally identified it, of him behind the performers during the Jimi Hendrix performance. So maybe he can talk about that a little bit more here in a few minutes. But we do want to go to the phones right now. We have Ray listening on KIPI in South Dakota. Ray, you're on the air.
All right. You're talking about our heroes. Yeah, when I was going on Woodstock, those guys were standing over here around the jukebox listening to Hey Jude by John Lennon. He goes, what? Well, there's not a gathering going on over on the East Coast. We're going tomorrow. Grandma looked at it and goes, no, you're not. There's too many people over there, man. So we were aware of that kind of music. I had like Jim Morrison and Doors, had a collection of Beatles like that. So we wanted to go, but I never had a chance. But now I still listen to his music this day. You can't give up the music. That's the best music in the world. Oakville, gave me some time to talk. So you guys talking about the good old days, and I commemorate those ones that are there. Teepees on the hill. That sounds cool. Anyway, signing off, Zen Man. Oh, hey, Pilama Apollo.
Ray, thank you for those comments, and I'm sorry your grandma wouldn't let you go to Woodstock. Let's take another caller. We have Kenneth listening on KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Kenneth, you are on the air.
Hey there. Yeah, I was 17, and my friend was 16, and we were in Baltimore. And, you know, we thought we'd go up there and see The Who, and there'd be like 25 or 50,000 people. We told our parents we were going on a school field trip when they dropped us off at the high school parking lot with a busload full of freaks. Got to somewhere along the New York State Thruway about 5 in the morning, and the bus driver said, well, that's it, guys. And we said to him, well, how far is the concert? Where do we go? He said, oh, it's just over that hill. It was still dark. So we got out of the bus. And wound up hiking till 2 o'clock in the afternoon to get to the concert site because the thruway was just completely blocked. And then we found a spot on the hill. It wasn't filled in. We did a little purple haze, went to sleep, woke up a couple hours later, and as we were coming on, and the place was full, and it was just a sea of people. One of the most remarkable things in that whole event was that my friend and I got separated in that concert. Somehow, you know, we just got parted. And we were both alone. We were kids. And somehow we wound up bumping into each other again in that sea of 500,000 kids and saw the concert through. I remember the rainstorm when I was hugging a tree for warmth, because all I had was my t-shirt the whole time. And that, you know, I mean, that's just a little snapshot right there.
Well, Kenneth, thank you for calling in with those comments. Charlie, I'd like to ask you again, you know, we were talking about this Jimi Hendrix performance. You were on stage. Sharon remembers being on stage. What do you remember about that specific performance that closed out the concert?
Well, I was not really a big fan of his. I didn't know his music. I was living in the Pueblo at the time, and so I wasn't up to contemporary music at the time. They announced that he would be coming on, and it was still kind of dark, and we went down to Rosanna was a big fan of his, and we got down to the stage, and we were like leaning on one of the speakers watching him play, and he was having a great time. You could tell he was but like I said, I was not a big fan, didn't know his music at all, so that's about all I can say about that. It was just, when it was over, we were kind of backstage and walked down to where all the performers, they had a performer pavilion, and walking around back there, looked down in the mud, and there were two Woodstock nylon jackets. I still have one of them. And then we walked out in front of the stage, and it was a foot of mud at least, maybe more than that. And anything in the whole wide world that you would ever need or want to go camping with, or you could have found it there, except it was covered with mud. And I forget how many sleeping bags they saved. They took them and cleaned them, and then they gave them out to various people in New York, homeless people in New York. Well, I understand that's kind of cool.
Thank you, Charlie. That's a good story there. I'd like to take another caller. We have Daryl listening on WOJB in Hayward, Wisconsin. Daryl, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, several years ago at the Winnipeg Folk Fest, I had, working for WOJB, I had the chance to interview Richie Havens up at the Folk Fest. And I graduated from high school in 1967. I did not go to Woodstock. But that music and that era was part of my time then. And I asked him about his time at Woodstock, and it was probably one of the best interviews I ever had. He spoke about how he was in his hotel room, and a helicopter landed in the parking lot and came and grabbed him because they said they're having a hard time getting other performers to get to the stage venue. And he was the easiest one to grab since it was just him and his guitar. So he got on there, and when he flew over, you know, he had heard that there was like 400,000 people there, but he said as he came over the hill, he saw there was probably more like 800,000. He got up to the stage and he told, I'm forgetting the names right now, but anyway, he told what the director of the performance all around that if anybody threw a beer bottle at him, he's quitting. They wanted him to go on, and they had to talk to him for like about an hour before he would finally go on. And he said that he got up there and he played everything he knew. And when the part that's in the movie where he sings about a motherless child, he said that he ran out of everything that he knew, and he's trying to think of something. And he remembered that song as something he learned in church when he was a young boy. So he brought that all together for that performance. So that was a kind of an impromptu thing that he threw together. But also the thing that's interesting, you mentioned about the fact wondering if there were Native people there. I did not know this until I was interviewing him. I noticed that one of the things as interviewers, you know, we look at the person we're interviewing and see if there's any clues, anything we want to talk about. And I noticed he had Native American jewelry and necklaces and such that he was wearing. And I asked him that. I told him that. I said, you know, I see you've got this. I said, can you speak about that? And he told me that his grandfather had been part of Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, and that he traveled with him, with Buffalo Bill. And then when they got to the New York area, that his grandfather left the show then. And he said, Richie Havens said that when he was a young kid, they used to go to a reservation there, and he never knew why until later on in his life that was why, is because they were connected to that. And I can't think of that tribe now that he was a part of, but that was part of his heritage.
Well, thank you so much, Daryl, for those comments. Charlie, I want to ask you, we're running down to the wire here on our show, but in one word, how would you describe your Woodstock experience, Charlie Bird?
Wow.
Charlie, what happened after the concert? How'd you get home?
Oh, that was easy. Once again, John Morris told us that they had rooms booked for us in some hotel in New York City. Unfortunately, a bunch of us went, maybe 10, 15 of us, and we found a hotel, but they would not honor our reservation because I guess they heard that the place was going to go bankrupt. And so we had to get our own rooms, and it was interesting and fun buzzing around Times Square looking for a decent room, and it was a very interesting location. But we made out. I think I was one of the people that made any money there because, like I said, a lot of the artwork didn't get delivered, and so they didn't get a chance to sell it. But I had jewelry, which was in a small case, which I could carry with me, and I set that up, and I was basically by myself, and I made what I thought was quite a bit of money at the time, so it was great.
So you were able to sell some artwork. That's great. What kind of artwork did you have with you?
Pardon?
What kind of artwork did you have that you were able to sell? What was your jewelry?
Oh, just like a couple of bracelets, some rings, some necklaces. The thing that my aunt was trying to make me take were there are these things that I don't know who makes them. I think they're made in some factory in Japan or something, but they're beaded beads with glass beads here and there, and they're nice, and they retailed like for $5. And she wanted me to take a bunch of them, and I refused. I did not refuse. I just said no because this is New York, and everybody's got a lot of money, and I'm wrong. I sold all the ones that I had. Okay. And it was just fun meeting all those people, talking to them. And like I said, it was just, I just set out open.
Yeah, great, great, great stories, Charlie, Sharon, Sandy. Folks, we're quickly approaching the end of our hour for today's show, a story of a group of young Native artists who took an extraordinary trip in the summer of 1969. Before we wrap up, I'd like to take a moment to explain the inspiration for our show. As many of you know, I've been hosting Native America Calling this fall, and it's been an incredible experience for which I'm extremely grateful. I first learned about the group from IAIA that traveled to Woodstock a few years ago. I reached out to living members I was able to track down, did some interviews, studied up on events. I wasn't sure what to do with the information, but I knew I had something special and it had to be documented. So I filed my notes for a rainy day. Well, that rainy day arrived today, like the torrential downpour that drenched, cleansed, and empowered the Woodstock generation. With that, let me thank my guests, Charlie Bird, Sandy Fife Wilson, Sharon Mouse, and their Woodstock companions who either by fate or circumstance were not able to join us today. You have gifted us all with understanding. You have gifted us with inspiration. You have gifted us with pride. And on behalf of all Native people, let me just say, rock on. We are back again on Monday with a show about a program that provides support for Indigenous prisoners in the Pacific Northwest. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. We had help this week from Luella Bryan. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director, and Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations. The president and CEO of Kahonic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. And I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Have a great weekend.
Heshe, istan ko telan ahoy to the kwahonayu yanawa me. Us is open enrollment options November 1st and January 15th and after the home production with the delaganawa. Yam to lakwa mosawa shu up to etadaptonis healthcare.gov finawa and etadaptonis 1-800-318-2596 something and akin up to. Look, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services don't not benefit to look at our. Elakwa.
The Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention remind you there are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States. You may choose which COVID-19 vaccine you receive as a booster shot. Getting the COVID-19 vaccination protects you, your family, and your community. More information at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.